Today is Wednesday, April the 2nd, 2025. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how big tech companies and our government are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a three-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.live, that's PRN.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your questions or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Microsoft insists, connect to the Internet when installing Windows 11. Microsoft is no longer playing nice, as it is now requiring every Windows 11 device be set up with an Internet-connected account. In its latest Windows 11 Insider preview, the company says it will take out a well-known bypass script that let end users skip the requirement of connecting to the Internet and logging in with a Microsoft account to get through the initialization process of a new PC. As reported by the publication Windows Central, Microsoft already requires users to connect to the Internet, but there's a way to bypass it. The bypass NRO command for those setting up computers for businesses or secondary users, or simply, on principle, refuse to link their computer to a Microsoft account. The command is super simple to activate during the Windows setup process. Microsoft cites security as one reason it's making this change, saying, we're removing the bypass NRO.cmd script from the build to enhance security and user experience of Windows 11. This change ensures that all users exit setup with Internet connectivity and a Microsoft account. As of late, Microsoft has been making it harder for people to upgrade to Windows 11 while also nudging them to move on from Windows 10, which will lose support in October. The company is cracking down on the ability to install Windows 11 on older PCs that don't support TPM 2.0 and hounding you with full-screen ads to buy a new PC. Microsoft even removed the ability to install Windows 11 with old product keys. If you're looking to bypass the Microsoft account requirement during the installation of Windows, there are a few methods you can consider. One of the simplest methods is to unplug your network cable or disconnect from Wi-Fi during the installation process. This will prompt Windows to allow you to create a local account instead of forcing you to sign in with a Microsoft account. Another method involves entering a bogus email address when prompted for Microsoft account credentials. For example, you can use an email format like no@thankyou.com. When you attempt to log in with this fake account, you will receive an error message which allows you to proceed with the installation and set up a local account. You can also create a temporary Microsoft account using a disposable email service. This allows you to complete the installation without using your primary email. Just ensure that you have access to this temporary email for verification purposes, if needed. Using fake or temporary accounts can pose security risks, especially if you plan to use the system for sensitive tasks. Always consider the implications of bypassing account requirements. Microsoft frequently updates its installation processes, which may affect the effectiveness of these methods. Always check for the latest information regarding installation requirements. By following these methods, you should be able to bypass the Microsoft account requirement storing Windows installation effectively. Microsoft asking users to delete their passwords. Microsoft has confirmed a major update for over 1 billion end users as the deletion of passwords for all users becomes real. Your Microsoft password, it warns, could be easily forgotten or guessed by an attacker, and it's now time to completely remove the password from your account. The password era is ending. Microsoft warned in December, bad actors know it, which is why they're desperately accelerating password-related attacks while they still can. With 7,000 attacks on passwords blocked per second, almost double from a year ago, the company is on a mission to convince a billion users to love passkeys. A passkey replaces password and two-factor authentication, that's 2FA codes, with account authentication linked to your hardware devices, or devices and secured by the same passwords. This means a passkey cannot leak or be stolen as it requires that physical hardware device, and unlike two-factor authentication, it cannot be intercepted or bypassed. Starting in April, Microsoft will begin rolling out a new sign-in and account creation experience that centers on passkeys, according to a press release from Microsoft. The tech giant has urged users to abandon the Microsoft account passwords in favor of passkeys, marking a significant shift in its security strategy. New Microsoft account holders will no longer be asked to set a password. Instead, they will verify their email once and create a passkey. Existing accounts will see a redesigned sign-in experience that promotes passkey as a default option. Our ultimate goal is to remove passwords completely, the company said in a security update posted back in December. Passkeys are tied to a user's physical device and are unlocked by something unique to the user, such as a fingerprint, face scan, or the device PIN. The company believes that implementing passkeys is the most effective solution to these security challenges. Passkeys can't be phished, guessed, or intercepted like passwords can because they are securely stored on the device and never leave it. According to Microsoft, millions of users have already deleted their passwords. The company also said that passkeys are 3 times faster than typing in a traditional password. Microsoft insists, connect to the internet when installing Windows 11. Microsoft is no longer playing nice, as it is now requiring every Windows 11 device be set up with an internet-connected account. In its latest Windows 11 Insider preview, the company says it will take out a well-known bypass script that let end users skip the requirement of connecting to the internet and logging in with a Microsoft account to get through the initialization process of a new PC. As reported by the publication Windows Central, Microsoft already requires users to connect to the internet, but there's a way to bypass it. The bypass NRO command for those setting up computers for businesses or secondary users or simply, on principle, refuse to link their computer to a Microsoft account. The command is super simple to activate during the Windows setup process. Microsoft cites security as one reason it's making this change, saying, we're removing the bypass NRO.cmd script from the build to enhance security and user experience of Windows 11. This change ensures that all users exit setup with internet connectivity and a Microsoft account. As of late, Microsoft has been making it harder for people to upgrade to Windows 11 while also nudging them to move on from Windows 10, which will lose support in October. The company is cracking down on the ability to install Windows 11 on older PCs that don't support TPM 2.0 and hounding you with full-screen ads to buy a new PC. Microsoft even removed the ability to install Windows 11 with old product keys. If you're looking to bypass the Microsoft account requirement during the installation of Windows, there are a few methods you can consider. One of the simplest methods is to unplug your network cable or disconnect from Wi-Fi during the installation process. This will prompt Windows to allow you to create a local account instead of forcing you to sign in with a Microsoft account. Another method involves entering a bogus email address when prompted for Microsoft account credentials. For example, you can use an email format like no@thankyou.com. When you attempt to log in with this fake account, you will receive an error message which allows you to proceed with the installation and set up a local account. You can also create a temporary Microsoft account using a disposable email service. This allows you to complete the installation without using your primary email. Just ensure that you have access to this temporary email for verification purposes, if needed. Using fake or temporary accounts can pose security risks, especially if you plan to use the system for sensitive tasks. Always consider the implications of bypassing account requirements. Microsoft frequently updates its installation processes, which may affect the effectiveness of these methods. Always check for the latest information regarding installation requirements. By following these methods, you should be able to bypass the Microsoft account requirement during Windows installation effectively. IBM layoffs and job shifts to India. Following a report last week on IBM's ongoing layoffs, current and former employees confirm what many suspected. The U.S. cuts run deeper than reported, and the jobs are heading to India. IBM has been undergoing significant workforce restructuring, with reports indicating that job cuts in the United States are deeper than initially feared. Those layoffs are accompanied by a noticeable shift of roles to India, as evidenced by job postings and employee accounts. IBM's career site data highlights the scale of this transition. On January the 7th, 2024, IBM listed 173 open positions in India. By November 23rd, 2024, this number has surged to 2,946, and as of the latest update, it stands at 3,866 jobs in India. In contrast, the U.S. job postings during the same periods were 192, 376, and 333 respectively. This disparity suggests a strategic focus on expanding the workforce in India while reducing roles in the United States. Current and former IBM employees have shared troubling accounts of the layoffs. Some employees were instructed to train newly hired workers in India, only to be laid off afterward. A recurring sentiment among employees is that hiring is being prioritized in India, with managers reportedly stating, "I can only hire in India." Quality assurance, that's QA roles, have been entirely outsourced to India, leading to a decline in quality and efficiency. Experienced QA engineers with over a decade of expertise was replaced by new hires trained in just 6 months, resulting in frequent escalations. The shift has also affected team dynamics and operations. Meetings have been rescheduled to accommodate the Indian time zones, often disregarding the convenience of local teams. In January of 2024, IBM reportedly doubled the headcount for many teams with personnel from India, further emphasizing the company's focus on its Indian workforce. The layoffs are extensive, with thousands of employees reportedly affected. In 2025, IBM is expected to cut around 9,000 jobs in the United States, with significant reductions in the Cloud Classic division. These cuts are part of a broader restructuring strategy aimed at shifting roles offshore, particularly to India. IBM's workforce strategy reflects a clear pivot toward India, with significant implications for its U.S. operations. While this may align with cost-saving measures, it has raised concerns about the impact on quality, assurance, and employee morale. Are H-1B workers paid less than U.S. workers for the same job? Under U.S. law, employers hiring H-1B workers must attest that they will pay these workers at least the prevailing wage for the job in the geographic area where they will work. This is intended to ensure that hiring H-1B workers does not adversely affect the wages and working conditions of similarly employed U.S. workers. Despite these legal requirements, there is evidence suggesting that many H-1B workers are paid less than their U.S. counterparts. Reports indicate that some employers use the H-1B program to pay workers below market wages. For example, a study found that Deloitte paid H-1B workers approximately 10% less than U.S. workers in similar roles. Additionally, a report by the Economic Policy Institute revealed that many H-1B employers, including major tech firms, use the program to pay workers below median wages. Internal documents from companies show that cost considerations often lead to hiring H-1B workers at lower wages compared to U.S. workers. The cost of hiring U.S. citizens was significantly higher than hiring H-1B workers. While the law requires H-1B workers to be paid at least the prevailing wage, enforcement can be challenging. Employers may exploit loopholes or misclassify job roles to justify lower wages. This has led to criticism that the program is sometimes used to suppress wages rather than address genuine labor shortages. Although the H-1 program includes safeguards to prevent wage disparities, evidence suggests that many H-1B workers are paid less than U.S. workers for similar jobs. This disparity is often attributed to employer practices and insufficient enforcement of wage requirements. The competition between U.S. college graduates with STEM degrees and H-1B workers is a topic of ongoing debate. The H-1B visa program is heavily utilized by employers in STEM fields, particularly in technology, engineering, and computer science. H-1B workers are often hired to fill roles that require specialized skills, and employers argue that these workers help address labor shortages in STEM industries. Many U.S. STEM graduates face challenges in securing entry-level positions due to competition with H-1B workers. Some H-1B visas are issued to workers with lower education levels or less experience than U.S. graduates. This has led to concerns that the program may sometimes prioritize cost savings over hiring the most qualified candidates. For example, at MIT, 90% of undergraduate degrees are awarded in STEM disciplines, reflecting the institution's strong focus on science and technology education. According to MIT's 2024 data, only 44% of undergraduates find their first job in STEM fields. It is difficult to conclude that more than half of the STEM graduates at MIT are not qualified for STEM roles based on employment statistics. While there are concerns about wage suppression and potential misuse of the program, the H-1B visa system is intended to complement the domestic workforce, not to replace it. The debate over H-1B workers and U.S. STEM graduates highlights the need for a balanced approach. Need to reform the H-1B program, addressing issues like wage transparency, and ensuring that H-1B visas are used to fill genuine skill shortages can help alleviate concerns about unfair competition. As of now, there are approximately 600,000 H-1B workers employed in the United States. This figure represents a significant portion of the workforce under the H-1B visa program, which is the largest temporary work visa program in the United States and is utilized by around 50,000 employers. Big tech companies employ tens of thousands of H-1B workers collectively. Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and Meta are among the largest users of the H-1B program, with Amazon leading in recent years. U.S. proposes an H-1B wage hike, which could impact global hiring for tech talents. A proposed change to the H-1B visa program could increase minimum salary requirements for foreign workers in the United States, pushing employers to prioritize local talent. This may lead to fewer visas issued, challenges for specialized roles, and potential layoffs. Company might also consider moving jobs abroad, affecting the overall hiring landscape in the United States. A new proposal for the H-1B could reshape the way the hiring landscape works in the United States. It will impact the global talent pool and the future of foreign workers in the American job market. What is it and how does it impact you? The H-1B visa program allows U.S. companies to hire foreign workers in specialized fields. These fields typically require a bachelor's degree or higher. Some of the most common roles under this visa include engineers, architects, doctors, and IT professionals. However, the U.S. government is now considering a proposal that could make it more difficult for companies to hire foreign workers. The proposal would increase the minimum salary required for H-1B workers, pushing employers to pay higher wages than the market rate. It is important to understand that the entire point of hiring foreign employees is their willingness to work at a reduced pay cut compared to the employees a company can find in the country. Evidently, the U.S. government is proposing a significant change to the H-1B visa program. These changes could impact the way U.S. employers hire foreign talent, particularly in fields like engineering and science. Here's what the proposal means to you. Under the new proposal, U.S. employers would be required to pay a much higher wage to H-1B professionals. Specifically, the government would introduce a median local wage standard. This means companies would have to pay foreign workers more than they would typically pay for similar roles filled by American workers. This move aims to ensure that U.S. employers prioritize local talent, which is understandable, as each country should work on empowering its citizens. However, experts warn that it could reduce the number of foreign workers hired, which could impose challenges for highly specialized roles like scientists and engineers. After all, the brilliant minds can come from any part of the world. What is the impact on foreign workers? If passed, the changes could lead to several challenges for foreign-born workers. The proposal could discourage international students from applying for H-1B visas, mainly because they might not meet the high wage requirements. Companies may also become reluctant to hire foreign talent. There could also be layoffs for currently working foreign employees with H-1B visa. In short, companies may be less inclined to hire foreign workers if they have to pay more than the market rate. In fact, this change could even push companies to move jobs out of the United States rather than hiring expensive foreign workers. This could either be beneficial or highly disadvantageous, as we could be looking at more remote job possibilities. As a result, the potential outcome might not be more jobs for Americans, but a possible shift in where work is done. Senator Bernie Sanders proposed an amendment earlier in 2025 that aimed to raise the minimum salary for H-1B visa holders. The amendment suggested that companies pay over $80,000 annually to hire a recently graduated software developer. This would represent a 72% increase from the current threshold of $60,000. While the Senate did not vote on this amendment, it highlighted the ongoing efforts to raise salaries for foreign workers. With this increased benefit, U.S. workers, or will it make it harder for employers to hire foreign talent? Apart from hiring, it could also mean that the current foreign employees may come under fire. There could be potential job cuts and layoffs in the era of AI, where retaining jobs is already challenging. This new policy might make it even more brutal for foreign employees. However, the new changes, if passed, could affect how many people are chosen in future registration periods. U.S. employers may face difficulties meeting the higher salary requirements, which could impact hiring plans for international talent. The proposed wage hikes for H-1B workers are part of a broader effort to reform U.S. immigration policy. The hope is that these changes will ensure that American workers are prioritized. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and a lot of what's going on. And along the way, we see a lot of different things in regards to the return to office mandates. And yes, I've talked about this over the course of the past couple of weeks, and we'll talk about this just a little bit more today and maybe in the next week or so. And I wanted to hit on some different things that I've been hearing. And the idea of returning to the office is something that I feel more and more strongly against. I feel about this very strongly, and I've struggled with the idea of this, especially since I've seen the other side here, and I've seen where we can be productive. Now, am I going to say that everybody needs to be work from home? Do I think that everybody needs to be remote? No, I believe that there are areas where we can get better. But some of the excuses that were being given to for everybody to return to office is a little bit uncomfortable. I don't find them to ring true. I don't want to go to the extent that I'm calling them lies, but it doesn't feel right for me. For instance, one of the things I've heard bandied about is collaboration is better in person. Okay, I'll tell you, I've been in a number of different offices over the years, and sometimes collaborating with people in the office is good. Could that have been done via some kind of video call? Yes, especially since a lot of the collaboration for me was, one of them comes to mind. I sat down with a couple of programmers once a day and once a week. And we would sit and we would spend some time face to face. Could have been done via video call. Could have been done with sharing screens and stuff like that. But we would communicate with each other for a short period of time, and then they would have their marching orders, and then they would go on off and they would deal with whatever they were going to do for the next day, for the next week. And they got their job done without my micromanaging every single thing they did. And I'll tell you, in some of the companies I've worked with, one company comes to mind. I went to work for a company where it was packed. The office was packed. We didn't have cubicles in the standard sense, as a matter of fact. So we would have a cubicle wall between myself and the people across from me, but it was just at the height of probably about a foot over the top of my desktop. So I could see all the way on down, all the way around to everybody around. But the person next to me didn't have a wall between us. Her desk extended from where my desk was, and our boss extended from there. So we didn't even have cubicle walls. So what did I do? I wore headphones because I wanted to kind of tune out all of the different distractions that were going on. If I can't hear myself think over the phone calls of the person that is in the next cube over or across the way or wherever, that is not going to give me good productivity. Sure, I can shout across the room and say, "Hey, what do you think about us doing this? What do you think about that?" But then I'm also distracting the productivity of others. And I'll tell you, we had a lot of us wearing these noise-canceling earbuds and headphones like we were all in the airport. It's not all of that's cracked up to be, especially this open office concept. That actually drove me up the wall. And then there's the idea of mentorship only works in person. Well, I'm not sure about that. Okay, I can understand mentoring one person, but we're not all mentoring each other. And most of the mentorship that happens is a matter of little brief moments, a half an hour with somebody who's going to guide me towards being a better worker, who's going to guide me in a lot of the different things that I do, how to interact with others and so forth. But mentorship, working a senior employee with a junior employee, working together, that isn't really going to be about anything that we have to have at the same location. side by side all day long. This is something that is a half an hour a week. We can do that over a phone call. We can do that over asking questions via whatever kind of instant messaging app that you've got. There's a lot there. So mentorship is leadership. Mentorship is investing in people for a period of time, bettering the people that are coming along that will eventually fill our shoes, versus the whole idea. Mentorship isn't just sitting together and just learning by osmosis. No, it's about that focus time. And focus time can be handled in so many different ways because of the advent of technology that allows us to communicate. I mentored people in India from the Midwest. I was mentoring them and guiding them, and I had a number of different communications with them throughout the week. And I brought them to a better place just by communicating with them on a regular basis and guiding them towards what I saw was a way for them to improve themselves, our team, and the company. If I can do it in another country with various language barriers, I mean, we were all speaking English, but, you know, there's still understanding. There's cultural barriers that we had to overcome. But I became a better person as well throughout all of that. If we can do that remote, why do we need to be in person? As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. When does tech ageism start in the United States? Ageism in the tech industry often begins to affect professionals as early as their mid-30s to early 40s, though it becomes more pronounced for those age 45 and older. This is supported by data and anecdotal evidence highlighting the challenges faced by older workers in the youth-dominated field. Many professionals age 45 and above report experiencing or witnessing ageism in the workplace. This is a critical point where age discrimination becomes more visible, as younger workers are often prioritized in hiring and promotion decisions. The 2022 Stack Overflow Developer Survey revealed that less than 11% of professional developers were age 45 or older, underscoring the tech industry's preference for younger employees. Some individuals report encountering ageism even earlier, in their mid-30s, particularly in startups or companies with a strong youth culture. The tech industry often values traits stereotypically associated with younger workers, such as adaptability to new technologies, willingness to work long hours, and a perceived alignment with startup culture. This bias can lead to older workers being overlooked, despite their experience and expertise. While age discrimination is illegal under the Employment Act, which protects workers over the age of 40, these laws are not always enough to prevent ageism in practice. In a rapidly changing tech landscape, professionals over 40 face unique challenges. Discover why having a backup plan is essential for job security, skill relevance, work-life balance, and financial stability. Technology changes so fast, and new tech, automation, and AI is replacing old jobs. Unless they plan for the future, techies can face career issues after 40. You will need a backup plan. Why a backup plan is needed? Because job is not always guaranteed. Tech companies reassign projects and teams anytime. Layoffs happen in a flash. Having something in reserve, you won't be adrift if your professional life is taken away from you. Old skills won't cut it. Technology is always evolving. Skills you learned years ago won't work. Unless you update your knowledge, younger tech people with new skills can replace you. Then there's work-life balance as it evolves. As you get older, you want a healthier work-life balance. Working late shifts and meeting deadlines is stressful. Having an alternative plan will make you find a less tiring and flexible job. You can start something new. Most techies in their 40s think of starting their own business or being consultants. Planning ahead gives you a chance to build business know-how and grow your network before you make the jump. Money matters. Losing your job at 40 can be tough if you have a family to support. Having a plan B, like freelance work, teaching, or running a small business can help you bring in extra cash and take the pressure off your wallet. Well, how to prepare a backup plan? Learn new skills, get updated with new technologies, grow your network, get to know professionals who can help you in finding new opportunities, earn from various sources, try freelancing, blogging, or consulting, get certified. Training in AI, cloud computing, or cybersecurity can lead to better job opportunities. Try different jobs. You can teach, guide others, or start your own business. Having a backup plan gives tech workers peace of mind about what's ahead. It's not that they're worried about losing their jobs, but they should be ready for changes. With good planning, techies can keep their careers strong even after they turn 40. COBOL's relevance in 2025. COBOL, a programming language over 60 years old, remains a cornerstone for critical financial and government systems worldwide. Despite the rise of modern languages like Java, COBOL continues to power major operations with an estimated 220 billion lines of COBOL code still in active use. Wondering why this legacy system is still needed today? Well, let's break it down. COBOL is not just old technology sitting around. It powers 95% of ATM transactions and 80% of in-person banking activities. Imagine using an ATM or making a banking transaction, and behind the scenes, COBOL is most likely handling it. According to a 2022 survey by Micro Focus, the global COBOL footprint has expanded to a massive 775 to 850 billion lines of code in production systems. This number far exceeds previous estimates and highlights how integral COBOL remains to critical infrastructure. While some tech communities argue that AI and newer programming languages like Java will replace COBOL, this is far from certain. Technologies like IBM Watson Code Assistant are trying to modernize the language landscape, but many experts aren't convinced. One COBOL developer on Reddit mentioned that AI tools like ChatGPT can only generate initial code. However, human oversight remains essential for complex tasks. AI doesn't provide the depth and understanding needed for real-world business logic. Plus, organizations still prefer human experts who can explain why they wrote the code in a specific way, something AI often cannot do. The survival of COBOL is rooted in reliability and business-oriented operations. In fact, 92% of organizations consider their COBOL applications vital for day-to-day operations. This is especially true in finance, where COBOL handles daily millions of transactions. But it's not just about sticking with old technology. Companies are choosing to modernize their COBOL systems rather than replacing them altogether. According to the same survey, 64% of businesses plan to modernize their COBOL systems, and 72% view modernization as key to their future business strategy. This shift allows organizations to continue using their core COBOL systems while integrating newer technologies like HTML, JSON, XML, and even AI to improve front-end interface and user experiences. With a massive amount of COBOL code still in use, there's a growing demand for COBOL developers. As of June 2024, the average salary for COBOL programmers stand at $84,000 a year, potentially reaching $112,000 per year. The job market for COBOL developers is set to remain strong for years to come. While it's true that only a handful of companies require COBOL expertise, the demand for skilled developers is high. If you're thinking of jumping into COBOL development, it's wise to expand your skills in mainframe systems and learn about legacy technologies like CICS, DB2, mainframe systems, IBM utilities, SyncSort, and JCL scripting. This will increase your value in the job market. COBOL isn't just a piece of old technology gathering dust. It remains essential for many critical systems across industries, especially finance and government. While modernization efforts continue, COBOL's reliability and adaptability ensure it will remain relevant for years. If you're looking to break into a rewarding field, mastering COBOL and its related technologies could be your ticket to a long-term career with high pay and job security. Masking your email addresses. You've heard of burner phones. What about burner email addresses? So much of the internet now requires that you hand over your email address before you're able to use any services, from an app you've downloaded to signing up for a newsletter or redeeming a special offer online. But who says you have to give your real email address? Next time you're asked, consider using an email mask. There are a growing number of services that give out disguised email addresses and relay any messages to your actual address. Experts say this can be a powerful tool to safeguard privacy and security. The idea behind email masking is simple. The masking service gives you a randomized address you can use as a decoy instead of your actual email. It can be a series of unrelated words or a string of letters and numbers. When someone sends a message to the burner email, it will be automatically routed to your address without anyone knowing. Providers include privacy-focused search engine DuckDuckGo's email protection service, Firefox Relay from browser maker Mozilla, email service Fastmail, and independent services like Addy.io, that's ADDY.io. The encrypted service ProtonMail offers email masking with its password manager and standalone simple login service. There are many others. It's one of the features Apple offers users subscribing to its iCloud Plus or Apple One services. When you're using the Safari browser app on your iPhone and need to input your email, you can tap the field above the on-screen keyboard to hide my email, which then creates a random address as a substitute. It's also available on Mac computers with the desktop Safari browser or Mail app. If you're using a different browser or app, you can still manually create a random email address by going into your iCloud settings. Most services have a free version with basic options and a premium tier with more features. Some free services can only receive emails but not reply to them. However, an important feature users should look for is the ability to do both. Most masking services have a dashboard control panel where you can view the various aliases addresses that you've activated. If you've noticed one starting to get a lot of spam, just turn it off. Mask your email when you want to add an extra layer of privacy or protect yourself from data leaks or unauthorized information sharing. An email address is a general-purpose tool that can be used in any context. There are two key situations in the use of email masking. The first is when you're unsure what a website will do with your email address. Masking your email gives you control. If you start receiving unwanted messages, you can easily block any emails coming to that email mask. The second scenario is when your association with a service could reveal sensitive personal information. There are a whole host of reasons not to give out your email address to anyone who wants it. It could be sold to marketeers or shady data brokers, eroding your privacy by helping them build a profile view for legitimate or nefarious purposes. If your address ends up on the wrong mailing list, it could result in more junk or phishing emails, and if an online service is hacked, attackers could make off with logins, passwords, and other personal information. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston joins me now. And Marty, I understand somebody reached out to you.
it's a mutual friend. And for those of you who are out there, this is one of the first guys who was ever doing computer shows on the radio.
Oh, you're talking Hank.
Hank Key.
There you go. Correct. Yeah, yeah, okay.
Now, forgive me. His first name is Hank. His last name is Key, K-E-E. His name is not Hanky.
All right. Yeah, I've got my handkerchief here just in case.
For a long time on the radio, and my wife always thought this was funny, his co-producer, co-host was Joe King, the late Joe King.
Yeah, yeah.
So are you joking or are you a Hanky? Personal Computer Radio Show is still on the air, and they run these segments of ours.
Yes, yes.
And I got a surprise call from Hank the other day while I was driving home.
Okay.
He said, Marty, you helped me get a hold of some backup power supplies a while back.
Yeah.
What's a while back for Hank? I mean, 14th century, we don't.
Ye old power supply company.
And he said, we had a little outage here.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't kick in. All of a sudden, you know, we had the outage and things actually turned off.
Mm-hmm.
I said, Hank, how long have you had that backup supply? He thought maybe 12, 15 years.
Oh, ouch. Oh, even the battery technology has changed since then.
Many times. A couple of times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's old. Yeah. those batteries, what, from back then? What was that?
Lead acid.
Yeah. Yeah.
Encapsulated lead acid. Some of them were gel cells.
Yeah. But you'd get maybe two.
4 years. 4 years on
okay,
a stretch.
4 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, two is smart, four is, you know, if you're lucky.
Yeah. Okay.
And as a rule,
mm-hmm.
rather than replace batteries, it used to be cheaper to throw the thing away and go buy a new one.
Yeah, yeah. I would go to specialty battery stores, Batteries Etc., I think was the name of the place.
Batteries Plus, wasn't it?
Maybe. Batteries
could
Plus is a chain, I think. But I would take the battery into them. I wouldn't tell them what it was. And they would check it. They'd check the specs, and they'd sell me another battery for a very reasonable amount versus
what? No markup
versus the versus the OEM, which has tons of markup built into it. Kind of like the toner in toner cartridges.
And back then, I might add,
yeah,
you didn't have the penalty of volumetric shipping where you had something that was both big and really heavy.
Yes, yes.
So getting it shipped to you was a cost that no one wanted to eat. Well, I explained to Hank. I said, first of all, mm-hmm. batteries die.
Mm-hmm.
Yours reached a ripe old age. I hope you continue to do the same.
Yes.
But in terms of this product, mm-hmm. you can't expect them to last forever. That particular backup supply, and you know there are a lot of different architectures for these, was sure. a switching supply.
Mm-hmm.
It made sure, it managed the battery, made sure the battery maintained a charge level,
mm-hmm.
and the battery did not continuously provide AC power. It switched in to do that
mm-hmm.
in generally just short of 17 milliseconds.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So if there was an outage, your computer wouldn't see it because your computer can sustain for 40, 50, 60 milliseconds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Switching power supplies are one of the least expensive to build. You're essentially dealing with an inverter, mm-hmm. a battery charge management, and that's all. AC to DC, DC mm-hmm. to the battery, mm-hmm. battery mm-hmm. to the inverter's AC.
Yeah.
So a relay switches it, bang, you're done. I explained that to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, what can I do about it? I said, well, the first thing you should do about it is throw it away.
Yes, yes.
It's not helping you if it starts leaking or mm-hmm. anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Keep it plugged in. It's possibility of a fire if it overheats.
Yeah.
You don't want to deal with that. He said, why would it overheat if it doesn't work? I said, because you're still pumping juice in a battery.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, and there's another thing, too, because a lot of people use these battery backups. They use them for an additional feature, which is the surge suppression.
Yes.
And
that is invalidated before its second birthday.
Yeah, exactly.
In fact, I talked to somebody at CyberPower once, and I said, how can you tell? Because the light doesn't mean anything. How can you tell if the surge protector is still working? He said, there's only one way.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you have to cut it in half and use a microscope. And by that time, I guarantee you it isn't.
Yeah, a minor issue. Yeah.
What do we know about stuff? You know, my point about that is most of you guys out there, ladies too, don't need a backup system. You have one in that brick battery that's on your notebook. You're good for what? 4, 6, 8 hours based on the brick without plugging in to recharge it. Now, if you're using it for something, you know, else, if you've found a way to have a 5-volt powered air conditioner keeping you
Really
cool. Well,
my NAS is plugged into one, too. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's fine. But how many people are still on desktops? Go to a store and count the choices.
Yeah. Yeah. It is evolving. Definitely.
And also should mention lithium iron phosphate batteries, the new generation.
Okay.
Last longer, charge better, and there are easy ways to measure when it's approaching end of life.
Very cool. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. A clarification on my contact with Marty Winston on the UPS problem. My complaint was that there should be an indicator that the backup battery is no longer rechargeable. Most of the low-cost UPS units are still operational on the AC-only outlets. It is not apparent that the battery backup portion of the unit is not operational. So when one of the peripheral units could not be powered up, the initial reaction is that whatever is connected to the battery outlets is not operational. Design of form should follow function. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has its meeting on Friday, April the 4th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi, acgnj.org. The King's Bite Computer Club meets Tuesday, April the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. Phone number to confirm is 347-278-7320. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, April the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. And the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, April the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. And their website is limac.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, April the 24th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. And the website is bcug.com. Tech Ed Connect meets Tuesday, May the 6th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. It's a hybrid meeting. Meeting at the Scarsdale Public Library at 54 Olmsted Road, Scarsdale, New York, and online virtual meeting via Zoom. Their website is wpcug.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.